Joining me this week on the Moscow Report is Leonid Savin. He is the chief analyst of the Sargat Institute, headed by the famed Russian philosopher Alexander Dugin. He's one of Russia's top experts on the multipolar world and spends most of his time traveling the world, Venezuela, Iran, and next week he's off to Cuba. Mr. Savin, thank you for joining me. First of all, has the multipolar world already arrived? And how do you see it developing?
It depends from what point of view we'll see on multipolarity. You know, there's different theories, different scholars introduced this term, for example, in the 60s. And American scholars like Deutsch, Singer proposed one vision of multipolarity based mostly on positivist science. And of course, the pole means connected with physical geography. And in some sense, it's connected with bipolarity order. I mean, balance of Soviet Union and the United States at this time. There is another point of view proposed, for example, by John Mersheimer, the different types of multipolarity, unbalanced multipolarity or balanced multipolarity. There is point of view of nuclear multipolarity, that nuclear powers already kind of poles. Pakistan and Israel, in this sense, also actors of multipolarity. But for my opinion, it's better to rethink about what is pole. For example, I proposed in my book, Ordo Pluriversaris, point of view that Martin Heidegger told about pole. It's originally Greek word and also connected with polis, with politeia. And Heidegger told that it is kind of center of being of people. And his view, it Greek people, but we also can speak about Iranian people, about Chinese people, about Russian people. And from this point of view, there's many poles.
Because it seems that the Western model, if you like, based around NATO, is a kind of empire that's run from Washington, of Europe increasingly becoming vassals of Washington. But is the idea of multipolarity, the idea that there is no center to this empire? You look at Russia, China, Iran, they have a kind of friendship, but they all have their own sovereign interests. Is that the difference between the multipolar world and the Western idea?
Yes, of course, and it depends on what view. Because Chinese people not see the world future, God, like we Russians or Iranian people look on all these phenomena. And there's a kind of Western type of point of view, to need to control the world, that only one Western civilization exists. And from our point of view, there are many civilizations, Chinese civilization, Iranian civilization, Turkish civilization, etc. And of course, there's kind of interest of to provide security for our own sphere of influence. And if we speak about multipolarity, I see this contemporary moment like emerging multipolarity.
There's historically been a great deal of mistrust between Russia and Iran. How do you see their relationship now? Do you think it's strong enough to resist the Western desires to damage or destroy them both?
Yes, we have some historical conflicts between Persia and Russian Empire. But at the time, we have very good relations during the same period. For example, Russian troops assisted to suppress coup in Tigran in November 1916, when Turkish and German again tried to reorganize and to catch the power in Persia. And then it was time of Soviet Union, and of course, relation was not good because of Islamic revolutions. But then we developed very good economical, political ties on high level. And for last years, we see that also kind of public diplomacy development between countries. Of course, we need more cooperate with Iranian people. And because we have the same vision on the global world to assist oppressed people, the same vision on Palestine, for example, the same vision on our common enemies like United States and collective West.
Because I'm speaking to some Russian people, and there's an idea that Russia doesn't really understand Iran. or Iranian culture or history. You've been to Iran recently, I think a couple of years ago. How did you find the country, and what do you think could be done to create more trust between the two countries?
For Russians, ordinary people, Iran is an amazing country. It's a very ancient civilization that very interesting to see different aspects, because it's not only one ethnic group. It's like Russia, consists of many ethnic groups and many historical, cultural customs, tradition, etc. But for my opinion, for some last years, Kerbzadegi is coming back. Idea of proposed Jalil Ali Ahmad that the Iranian people are poisoned by the West, and now it's seems a little bit pro-Western trends inside of Iran, and a kind of MTV television, kind of Western dress of woman, man, etc. And I think it's not good. But from another point of view, I think technical modernization that's good for developing countries, despite of sanctions provided by the West against Iran.
Do you see Iran as strong at the moment? Were you impressed about in their war with Israel? Who won the war against Israel?
Of course, I am an external person who can analyze only by objective news coming from different sources. From my point, yes, and because Israel also stopped aggressions, and it seems that Iran held enough power to resist. And last news from different sources have kind of confirmation that Iran prepares for any type of new aggressions and would like to be more strongest than before.
And has the United States, do you think, accepted the multipolar world under their new president, Donald Trump? Is Trump adjusting their policy back towards their own hemisphere? Should Venezuela be worried?
America First is not about multipolarity. It's very clear. Even during time of Barack Obama, they proposed the idea of leadership about multilateralism. It's kind of pseudo-multipolarity. And the United States, of course, seems like a leader of global war. And Donald Trump would like to reorganize foreign policy, first of all, back to South America. It's in Latin America, experts and analysts told that it's kind of doctrine Monroe number two. And so what Trump doing now? I mean, pressure on Venezuela, pressure on Panama, other countries. But he also interested in Asia, because the real economical rise in Asia, in China, in Japan, in Korea, for many years ago. So he very afraid the rise of China, and of course it's threat number one for the United States and for Trump. So he tried to balance, and how it's possible, I don't know, because really economical system in United States now is very weak. He tried to bring more of assault back to United States. Why he pressure on European Union, this idea of new tariffs, also pressure on Japan and other partners.
Do you think he's doing a good job, or do you think he's understanding that the world has changed? One journalist said to me in Asia that Trump understands the changing realities of the world, but everything he's doing is still damaging their interests.
I think nobody wants hot conflicts and new wars, but everyone understands that time of United States is gone. So they would like to rebalance and try to find more opportunities. For example, Saudi Arabia, they organized a pact with Pakistan, defense pact. Another country is interested to more cooperations with BRICS club, joined to Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and to reorganize contacts with neighbor countries like Turkey do with Iraq, for example, and ideas, new corridors and new transport routes. So many actors who think about future, they understand that type of United States is gone, like main world power.
And is Europe too slow to respond to the changing realities of the world? It seems Europe is still stuck believing the world hasn't changed when it has. Are they too slow to recognize it?
The problem of Europe is Brussels bureaucracy. I mean the European Union institutions, because they are real very slow and they depend on the United States. Every country separately can do a great job, for example, like Hungary. United States not provided sanctions against Hungary to buy Russian oil and gas, for example. And some countries also balanced it. But in general, European Union is very bad project. It's mostly dying. And ordinary people understand that very well inside of Europe. So it's mostly problem of Brussels bureaucracy.
And is it in Europe's interest to have good relations with Russia? And why has that not happened?
In 19th century, Russian philosopher Nicholas Danilevsky told about root of the fears of Europeans on Russia. He told very simple, just look on the map, you will see that Europe is just a small western peninsula of continent. And there is huge land mass of Russian Empire. The Russian Empire was bigger than contemporary Russia, but it's mostly the same for now. They are afraid of Russian and they see us like other. They not understand Russian culture, Russian policy. Some people understand, some people love it, but like I told before, the problem with Brussels bureaucracy that depends of Euro-Atlantic pseudo-values. And of course, they see Russia like threat. But if we can cooperate in normal way and to respect each other, to trust each other, it will be prosperity for Europe, because cheap gas, cheap oil, and other resources, and very huge Russian market.
Do you see the United States had a plan to separate Europe and Russia?
Of course, it's a very old idea to separate main European powers like Germany, like France, from Russia. It's an idea based on some works of American scientists from late 19th century to separate China, Russia, and Germany. For example, it's idea of Helford Mackinder, idea of Spikeman, other geopolitical scientists. And till now, they have a project of decolonize Russia, and I mean it's separate Russia part by part. And
split Russia up.
Yes, and just to fight with Russia till its end. Of course, we cannot to accept this idea.
And is Europe right to be wary of China, or should they see China as an opportunity for mutual benefit?
I read many books of European after for last decades, and they are total anti-Chinese propaganda. They are afraid of Chinese techniques, about Chinese productions, and they propose idea to develop European goods, but it's not work. So there is question, why Europe cannot do it? Why they depend on Chinese goods? It's question to Europe. Another factor is European historical racism, xenophobia, because China civilization is different. The type of Mongoloid type, if we speak about classical anthropology, and Russian seems more like Europeans, but Chinese no. Chinese have a totally other type of culture. They have totally logic. Actually, they have not logic in a European sense, in sense of Aristotle, because they think in other way, very specific.
And how important is it that states embrace, because I know you've written about this, how important is it that states embrace religion and tradition rather than the liberalism which is so pervasive in the West?
If we see like liberalism works in progress, it's going to extermination of human being itself. And religion, it means that connect.
Why do you say that? Why do you say it?
Because it started from liberation of church, of human history, of customs, church, tradition, religious, then traditional values, then statehood, because ultimate goal, there should be no state. It should be one world by liberal ideology, globalist. And of course, they need no traditional customs and need no religions, different types of beliefs. But without belief, human being cannot exist. You see that majority of the world are full of any kind of traditions, different type of tradition. Abrahamic traditions like Christian, Muslim, of Judaism, and Buddhism, or even paganism tradition in different corner of the world. So it for millenniums. And why we should accept idea to be without belief, be without religion, if it worked for many, many ages ago? Support people, and people need it. And there is no any contradiction between a kind of technical development and beliefs. And we can too go to the external space and also believe in God. But I see no problems. So it's problem of liberalism itself.
And you are starting to see in Europe and indeed in America kind of coming back of tradition, patriotism, in part Christianity. Do you think that's essential for Europe to get rid of this ideology of liberalism and start having more of traditional values and patriotism? Is that the only way that Europe can save itself?
It's more easy to destroy than construct. So for Europeans need to reorganize education, to reorganize state system, to reorganize Ministry of Culture, etc., etc. It's a long way. So it was a very big mistake with multiculturalism, first of all, and also a historical mistake with Enlightenment, because they started to produce some very destructive ideas and that supported in other regions and other corners. Of course, it's part of history, it's part of European philosophy, but it should be reversed, I think.
And when do you think the special military operation in Ukraine will end, and what will the world look like when it does?
When the West will stop support of Ukraine, at least technically, military, it will be finished very quickly. And of course, Russian the leadership has very clear goal to combat neo-Nazism in Ukraine, to combat Ukrainian militarism, and to provide assistance and support to Russian people there, because they are oppressed by contemporary neo-Nazi regime. And not in only eastern, southern regions of Ukraine, but also in the central parts, in the west, because Russian Orthodox Church is prohibited, the other political parties prohibited, that only need to support neo-Nazi regime of Zelensky. So it's a kind of new dictatorship that should be destroyed. It's kind of new Nazism, and that also should be destroyed. It's also threat to European countries, because we see a contraband of weapons from Ukraine to different markets through Europe, of course. To also recently it was a scandal in Romanian border, and there was some weapon planet to be go to Israel, and so it's also threat to many countries, not only for Europe.
And why do you think at the moment Trump is trying to push peace in Ukraine, a new deal, and it's the Europeans who are stopping it? How can you explain that Trump is I think genuinely trying to create peace in Ukraine, but it's the Europeans who are stopping it, and when it's European industry that's being damaged, European lives that are being lost. How do you explain that, the difference, the dichotomy of America is trying to create peace in Europe, but it's the Europeans that are blocking it?
I think Trump not understand how politics works. He's a businessman, and he personally thinks that maybe the United States will get some benefit from this conflict. Try to understand what Russia means doing this special military operation and how to stop it, and Putin provide him very clear agenda why we do it, what should be done, and how we can to stop sanction, how we can to cooperate again with the United States, etc. Maybe Trump think positively in this way, but he more theorist. Also, around him is a lot of hawks, a lot of neoconservatives who would like to continue this war because they have a personal business interest to provide weapons to Ukraine. And there is the problem. But of course, Russia understands very well what happens, understand interest of European countries, Brussels bureaucracy, understand the position of United States, and we will continue this operation when our goals will be finished.
But why do you think Europe is blocking it then?
Europe?
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of a Russophobic agenda, mostly, that in European political elites for the moment. Of course, there's a kind of old, good, skilled diplomats understand that conflict should be stopped, and the problem mostly from Ukraine. I mean, also terroristic acts on Nord Stream pipelines and also other activity of Ukrainian terrorists inside of European countries, what they're doing now in Poland, in Germany, in Italy, etc. The problem for political elites in Ukraine and in European countries.
And finally, are you confident about Russia's future?
I see that Russia's future will be in prosperity, because Russia is, in sense of geopolitics, if autonomous country and autonomous space. We have huge resources. We have autarky. We not depend. A little bit depends of some Western goods, but less and less from year to year. And in this sense, it's good that we started special military operation and we reorganizing our economic system. We are more close to global East, to global South, and it's also about multipolarity, because more Southern and Eastern powers cooperate with Russia, we cooperate with them, and we less depends on the collective West.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, "Allah is beautiful and loves beauty." Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature Spring of Truth will follow next. This program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And we finish off this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. In November 2025, Iraq held its sixth parliamentary elections since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. A total of 7,744 candidates from 31 electoral alliances competed for 329 seats for a four-year term. In these elections, several prominent Iraqi political forces presented their visions for governing the country and prioritizing reforms. Despite the differences in their rhetoric, most focused on shared concerns, such as building effective institutions, improving public services, and combating corruption. However, among the 31 alliances and approximately 7,744 candidates, hardly any address the issue of Iraqi sovereignty, which has been violated by the United States in their electoral platforms. Only a very small number of candidates, no more than a handful, mentioned this topic in scattered speeches, not in their platforms, referring to the sovereignty of a country that was invaded and besieged, where hundreds of thousands of citizens lost their lives. Following the 2003 invasion and the subsequent withdrawal in 2011, along with its return under the banner of the International Coalition in 2014, the United States has managed to exert systematic control over Iraq through a network of both visible and invisible pressure. This control is exercised through five key tools. 1. Monitoring financial flows by the U.S. Federal Reserves, effectively overseeing Iraq's dollar reserves and their overseas transfers. 2. Influence on security institutions through training programs and technical and technological support. 3. Indirect political influence by establishing relationships with influential forces and backing the so-called restructuring of the Iraqi state. 4. Influence in the oil sector, impacting contracts and terms set by American companies. 5. Military presence and threats, maintaining a military presence and making direct threats to security. For instance, the United States has imposed sanctions on Iraqi companies and individuals accused of collaborating with Iran or facilitating the evasion of American sanctions. Washington has also pressured successive Iraqi governments to sign large agreements with American companies in the energy, oil, technology, and health sectors, aiming to encircle Iraqi economic core and integrate it into the American system. The most alarming aspect is that the revenue from every barrel of oil sold by Iraq goes directly into an account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, giving Washington control over the oil revenues that keep the Iraqi economy afloat. In the week leading up to the elections, specifically on November 6, 2025, a technical meeting took place between U.S. and Iraqi officials to discuss the features of the bilateral security relationship and the future of coalition forces in Iraq, namely the U.S. military presence, which is opposed by an Iraqi political force, highlighting the complexity of the issue. In 2020, the Iraqi parliament passed a law mandating the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, but this law has yet to be implemented. In June 2025, Iraqi airspace was completely violated by Israeli planes attacking Iran with direct support from the United States. Despite this incident, no party that participated in the parliamentary elections included an explicit clause regarding the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq. Similarly, no Iraqi bloc adopted a clause demanding the release of Iraqi funds from the control of the Federal Reserve in New York. In summary, despite a partial military withdrawal, Washington still maintains a comprehensive network of influence that spans finance, security, and international relations. This makes issues related to sovereignty sensitive or nearly impossible to raise in an electoral context. The shift in strategy from direct military means to a form of soft power while still keeping a usable military club when necessary has created a reality in Iraq where every political force is aware of the American red lines that cannot be crossed without significant costs. For this reason, it's not hard to see why blocs and candidates steer clear of discussing the issue of military presence and American financial dominance. This is mainly due to the fear of sanctions, financial embargoes, and the designation of factions as terrorist organizations, which could lead to direct military attacks. It's essential to remember that from 2019 to 2024, in the period following the defeat of Daesh and when the U.S. presence in Iraq was officially part of the coalition, Iraqi figures, factions, and official armed forces were subjected to declared U.S. strikes. These attacks were justified under the pretext of responding to the assault on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, late 2019, due to the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps of Iran, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, head of the Popular Mobilization Unit's General Staff, early 2020. On the grounds of retaliating for an operation carried out by Iraqi factions against the U.S. military base in Jordan, early 2024. The disdain for Iraqi money in New York stems from its role as one of the most dangerous tools of American influence. 90% of Iraq's dollar transactions go through a system overseen by the United States, and any misstep or deterioration in relations could disrupt foreign transfers, limit Iraqi banking activities, or freeze a portion of reserves, as was seen on a limited basis in 2022 and 2023. In summary, the United States exerts comprehensive hegemony over Iraq in military, political, economic, and financial aspects. The reasons preventing Iraqi political forces from addressing this hegemony are the same ones that compel them to raise the issue of these archives. It's illogical for their country to be subjected to such a high level of external threats, with the United States turning their country's airspace into a corridor for Israeli planes to attack a neighboring country, while this level of danger is ignored under the pretext of American threats. The lack of candidates willing to open these files demonstrates Iraq's current weakness in the face of Washington and reveals the fragility of its security and financial stability. The silence is not due to neutrality or a matter of choice, rather it is a silence imposed by the equations of power and American hegemony. In this episode, we will examine the American hegemony over Iraq, a dominance whose simplest consequence is the restructuring of the Iraqi political landscape, and whose most severe outcome is the neutralization of Iraq from the causes surrounding it, which are its own. This has turned Iraq through the direct presence of American military forces into a platform that threatens both its own people and the nations in the region. In Geneva, Switzerland, in 1991, the then U.S. Secretary of State James Baker delivered a powerful message to Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. Iraq will be bombed and sent back to the Stone Age. 12 years later, Baker's prophecy came true. The United States invaded Iraq following a comprehensive embargo that plunged the country into hunger, led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and stripped them of their most basic human rights. While some may argue that Saddam's invasion of Kuwait justified the embargo and subsequent intervention, there are deeper reasons that warrant a thorough analysis. Italian sociologist and economic theorist Giovanni Arrighi argues that the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq was not merely a strategic blunder by the United States, but rather a historic turning point in the cycle of modern capitalism. According to Arighi, Iraq signified the end of a U.S. hegemonic cycle that began in 1945. This introduction is essential for understanding the significance of Iraq, its geopolitical relevance, and the capitalist and imperialist perspectives on the country. Arighi categorizes the history of capitalism into four cycles of hegemony: Genoese, Dutch, British, and American. In each cycle, the dominant power progresses through a series of phases. First, a phase of productive expansion. Second, a phase of financial expansion. Third, a crisis. Fourth, a war or military intervention aimed at preserving its hegemony. And fifth, a collapse. Arighi argues that the United States entered a phase of financial crisis and debt in the 1970s, when it lost its productive edge over East Asian countries. To safeguard its financial position, it turned to its military power, and Iraq became the perfect stage to reaffirm its hegemony through force. Why Iraq? Because according to Arighi, it was at the heart of the world's oil reserves, represented the central axis of the dollar-based financial system, and was geopolitically strategic for containing China's expansion and exerting pressure on Europe and Russia in the energy sector. Arighi states that the wars fought by empires during their periods of weakness hastened their downfall, just as the Boer War, which occurred in South Africa in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, signaled the beginning of the end for the British Empire. Similarly, the war in Iraq, according to his theory, marked the onset of the decline of American supremacy. Arighi believes that Washington's focus on Iraq and Afghanistan has allowed China to broaden its economic influence in Asia and Africa, forming energy alliances that attract industries and develop competitive infrastructures. In his view, China's achievements represent a structural revolution in the global economy. Arighi sees the U.S. occupation of Iraq as part of the evolution of global capitalism and its efforts to overcome its crisis. The Arab thinker Edward Said, although he did not live to see all the consequences of the invasion and occupation, interpreted the events in Iraq since 1991 as part of the structure of Orientalist discourse. Said criticized the use of phrases like existential threat or a regime that only responds to force, which were used to construct a media narrative that justified the war, portraying Iraq not as it was, but as the United States needed it to be perceived. Additionally, in 2012, researcher and writer Christopher Doran published a study titled How Iraq Threatened the U.S. Economic Empire and Had to Be Destroyed, which largely aligns with Arighi's theory. Doran draws a historical parallel from April 1917, when U.S. President Woodrow Wilson justified America's entry into World War I with the argument of making the world safe for democracy. However, Wilson's true motivation was to safeguard American corporate investments in Britain and France, ensuring that bankers like J.P. Morgan would recover the loans extended to these nations. From this viewpoint, World War I was fundamentally a war aimed at bolstering the security of capitalism. According to Doran, the same reasoning applies to Iraq after 1991. The suffering of the Iraqi people began with Saddam Hussein's war against Iran, followed by his invasion of Kuwait. The suffering was exacerbated during the sanctions period from 1990 to 2003. And escalated dramatically with the American invasion and occupation that is after 2003. Under the guise of a comprehensive economic reform, the United States aimed to establish the first neoliberal free market economy in West Asia, intending to monopolize the country's economic resources and investment opportunities for itself and its allies at the expense of the Iraqi people, their services, social welfare, and humanitarian needs. In the decades leading up to the suffering, Iraq stood in stark contrast to the neoliberal ideology and the model proposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Iraq was a significant oil-producing nation and benefited from market manipulation and oil price increases in 1973 and beyond. However, unlike Saudi Arabia, Iraq refused to send its oil profits to the United States in exchange for protection. Instead, it invested its oil revenues in development and encouraged other Arab oil-producing countries to follow suit. Duran states in his study, following the overthrow of the monarchy in 1958 and prior to the economic sanctions, Iraq was a nation focused on two main issues, development and Arab nationalism. This country had all the necessary elements to evolve into a developed nation like those in the global north. Iraq had a skilled workforce, an industrial base, education, health care, a strong infrastructure, abundant resources, an educated middle class, and an effective state apparatus. Joint Arab economic reports published by the Arab Monetary Fund over the years confirm that between 1958 and 1978, development indicators in Iraq showed faster than usual improvements in health, education, and social conditions. Furthermore, Iraq demonstrated a remarkable ability to reduce income disparities among its population. After Saddam's war against Iran and the invasion of Kuwait, the 1991 war devastated the country's infrastructure. Sanctions from 1990 to 2003 and Western aggression destroyed Iraqi society. The U.S. invasion in 2003 dismantled the state itself, turning the country into a scene of violence and collapse. Today, in 2025, 22 years after the invasion, the overthrow of Saddam and the lifting of sanctions, Iraq's electricity crisis continues. According to Christopher Duran, in the year 2000, Iraq directly challenged one of the foundations of American global dominance by refusing to accept dollars. This move made a military response from the United States unavoidable. One of the most crucial elements of the global economy and U.S. hegemony was the petrodollar, the requirement that oil, the world's most vital commodity, be sold exclusively in dollars. Following the invasion in June 2003, the U.S. military occupation resumed the sale of Iraqi oil in dollars. This military invasion followed the United States not only to take control of Iraqi oil, but also to ensure the continuation of the neoliberal agenda, dismantling the state, minimizing the role of government, and privatizing public services. These are core principles of neoliberalism. In a similar vein, and placing the war against Iraq within the framework of the global capitalist crisis, American Marxist thinker and political theorist David North published an article in 2010 titled "The Crisis of American Capitalism and the War Against Iraq." North argues that Saddam's regime was, in part, a byproduct of the bloody U.S. interventions during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, which aimed to eliminate the socialist labor movement in West Asia, a significant political force in the region. The question of the United States' role in the rise of Ba'athists in Iraq is debatable, particularly regarding the coup on February 8, 1963, which overthrew the nationalist and leftist regime of Abdul Karim Qasim and brought the Ba'athists to power with CIA support. However, David North contends that the primary goal of the United States was to control Iraq's oil reserves. He adds that all attempts to deny the crucial role of oil in the U.S. efforts to invade Iraq reek of falsehood and absurdity. No other natural resource has influenced U.S. imperialist political and economic calculations in the past century as much as oil and natural gas. When discussing oil, it's important to highlight that Central America's interest in crude is not just about ensuring profits for the massive U.S. oil companies, the U.S. industry, the stability of its financial structure, and its dominant global position rely on unrestricted access and control over the vast oil resources of the Persian Gulf and, more recently, the Caspian Sea Basin. According to North, the history of U.S. foreign policy and military strategy before 2010 can be examined from a purely economic viewpoint. As a response to the oil crisis of 1973, which occurred after the conflict between the Israeli occupying entity and Egypt, Syria, along with several supporting Arab states. North argues that this event had a significant impact on the U.S. economy and the global capitalist economy. The second oil crisis following the Iranian Revolution of 1979 led to the Carter Doctrine, which stated that unrestricted access to the Persian Gulf was a vital strategic concern for the United States. This, in turn, paved the way for the large-scale deployment of U.S. military forces in our region. The straightforward historical explanation, which places the war against Iraq in its economic context, brings us to the present day, where the United States continues to control Iraqi resources and plays a crucial role in the balance of power and wealth distribution in the region. In an article titled Eight Reasons Why the United States and Iraq Still Need Each Other, published by David Pollack on the Washington Institute's website in 2020, two key points were identified that highlight the economic interests of the United States in Iraq and justify its ongoing presence. One, the energy and financial value. Pollack stated that in addition to Iraq's geostrategic and political value, the country is now one of the largest oil exporters in the world, with vast long-term reserves. He argued that if the U.S. presence remains as it is, the economies of the United States, Iraq, and the global economy will collectively benefit from these resources. As was his custom before his death in 2024, Pollack used the Iranian spectrum to justify the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. He argued that if the United States withdrew, Iran would effectively increase its control over Iraq's vast energy and financial resources, hindering their use in Iraqi development projects to evade sanctions and promote its hegemonic ambitions. Two, Iraq as a regional counterbalance. The second point he raised also fits within the same context, stating that the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries were expected to start supplying electricity to Iraq in 2020 to lessen its independence on Iranian supply. According to Pollack, if the United States continued to be involved in the events, Iraq could shift from being a threat to becoming a partner with other Arab allies in the region. However, if the United States withdrew, some governments of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council and their populations might view Iraq as an even more subordinate state to Iran, either due to its Shiite majority or the departure of the main counterbalancing power. Furthermore, these governments' willingness to rely on the already questionable American guarantees would diminish even more after the withdrawal. All of this would increase the pressure on the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries to appease Iran, thus snatching a U.S. defeat from the jaws of victory. It's important to emphasize that although Pollack was an outspoken Zionist, his arguments reflect the true mindset of the U.S. administration and institutions to maintain their military presence in Iraq even under the guise of containing Iran. What has been presented so far illustrates the centrality of Iraq and its oil to the global capitalist system and specifically to U.S. hegemony over our country and the world. It's worth noting that since the 2003 invasion, the United States has exerted dominant control over the Iraqi oil sector. Four American companies, Coastal, Phoenix, Chevron, and Mobil, have taken on the management, investment, and marketing of a significant portion of the country's oil wealth. Many of the signed agreements have been illegal and unconstitutional. A recent example occurred in May 2025, when the Iraqi Kurdistan region announced contracts worth $110 billion with the American companies HKN Energy and Western Zagros, despite the opposition from the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, which declared them invalid. The ministry reminded that natural resources belong to all Iraqis and that any investment agreement must be managed through the federal government in Baghdad, in accordance with the law and the Constitution. On that day, in a speech delivered in Washington, Masoud Barzani, the Prime Minister of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, announced these agreements in a context where the United States supported the supply of oil and energy in the Kurdistan region. Meanwhile, Washington was preventing Baghdad from importing energy from Iran, citing compliance with sanctions. The United States refused to renew a waiver that allowed Iraq to purchase Iranian electricity without facing repercussions. This issue was also used as a pressure tool before the Iraqi parliamentary elections of 2025, aiming to facilitate foreign companies' control over the Iraqi electricity sector. The oil sector is the clearest evidence of U.S. dominance over Iraq, but another equally important aspect is the financial sector and the control of the dollar. Since 2003, Washington has been managing Iraq's oil export revenues by keeping these funds, the proceeds from oil sales, in accounts at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It's essential to remember that UN Security Council Resolution 1483 from 2003 mandated that revenues from Iraqi oil and gas exports be deposited into a special account known as the Development Fund for Iraq. A significant portion of this fund was allocated to pay $53 billion to Kuwait as compensation for the losses incurred during the war imposed by Saddam. It's important to highlight that the UN Security Council Resolution 1483 did not mention the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States as the custodian of these funds. However, Iraqi oil revenues are directly deposited into this account in New York. As of today, December 2025, Iraq continues to face restrictions on these funds, sometimes under the guise of combating terrorism and money laundering, and at other times under the pretext of protecting Iraq itself from lawsuits filed against it since the 1990s. In summary, the United States uses this fund, which is held in a New York bank, to manage Iraqi funds, oversee their usage, and employ them for political blackmail. It's important to note that despite this stringent American oversight, Iraq continues to be linked with corruption and embezzlement. This raises a crucial question. How is it possible that under such strict financial control, Iraqi officials managed to smuggle millions, even billions of dollars, out of the country? Beyond this contradiction, Iraq's financial situation today, in December 2025, remains questionable. Despite the accumulation of oil revenues in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which has reached $120 billion, Iraq faces a growing debt equivalent to the same amount, over $100 billion. Iraq's inability to manage its own finances hinders reconstruction and long-term development, forcing successive Iraqi governments to rely on international loans. Ironically, Iraq has also become one of the largest holders of U.S. Treasury bonds, with a total value reaching $41 billion in 2023. This means that instead of investing its money in profitable businesses or internal development projects, Iraq purchased U.S. bonds, effectively lending $41 billion to the United States. This investment in bonds does not yield high returns that the Iraqi people could have achieved if their government had invested these funds in productive sectors or large tech companies. To further illustrate the ability of the United States to influence Iraqi decision-making, it's important to note that in July 2024, the Central Bank of Iraq halted all foreign transactions in Chinese currency due to pressure from the U.S. Federal Reserve. This action was taken because the United States viewed payments in currencies other than the dollar as a threat to its financial dominance. Additionally, as part of its strategy to exert financial pressure on Baghdad, the United States prevented Iraq from passing a new law to regulate the popular mobilization units, PMU. This obstruction was achieved through political means and the threat of financial sanctions by refusing to pay the salaries of PMU members. In this way, the United States was able to impose its will on the Iraqis quite easily.
که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You are listening to The Spring of Truth, and I'm Muhammad Liaquat Abbas, your host, and I'm going to present you a beautiful and a very powerful quote from Imam Khomeini. Our beloved Imam Khomeini says, "Depriving the nation of a few of its popular personalities will not dampen its spirits." What will you get in your mind when you think about depriving the nation of its few popular personalities? It is nothing but just removing them from the face of the earth. Meaning, you have thought it right, meaning martyrdom, just killing them. If you are depriving the nation of a few of its popular personalities will not dampen its spirits. We have a beautiful verse in the Holy Quran where Allah says, if you support Allah, He will support you and make your footsteps firm. And we have a hadith where it says, trust is not measured by men, but it is measured by truth in the relatability of reality in life. Example, a forest will not die with the fall of a few great trees, isn't it? The forest still exists. The ecosystem persists and new growth emerges to take their place, often making the forest more resilient. So a movement built on a principle which is immortal, even